Thank you, Don. And thank you for introducing me. I don't think I gave you thanks for that. Okay, the next video clip I have is an interview with Elizabeth Sarturis. She's an internationally known evolution biologist, futurist, speaker, and sustainability consultant to businesses, government agencies, and other organizations. I don't know those of you who have been coming to Word and Life for a while, if you remember, Elizabeth used to live in Santa Barbara, and she spoke at Word and Life when we were doing, I think in, you could actually go on the website and hear her talk. In 2006, I think it was, when we were doing Religion in Exile. I'm just fascinated by her, and I hope you'll like this. This is actually an hour-long interview, but I'm only going to play 20 minutes of it. You can find it online if you want to listen to the rest of it. But so let's listen to what she has to say.
It may be odd to be talking to an evolution biologist about economics, but I don't see a difference between the two. For one thing, the words ecology and economy come from ancient Greek roots, and ecology is the ecos, household, and so is economy a household. They both come from the word ecos, but economy is the ecos nomos, which means the law or rule of the household, and ecology is the ecos logos, and that's the organization of the household. And why would you separate the structure of the household, the organization of the household, from the way it is run, the rule of the household? So I pointed that out once in one of Clinton's meetings on sustainability, because they had spent the whole morning talking about why should we talk about ecology in or economy, why should we talk about economy when this is a meeting about, I said it again wrong, why should we be talking about ecology when this is about economics? Okay. Anyway, the real reason that I, as an evolution biologist, have gotten myself involved with economics is because, as far as I know, economics is about the acquisition and transformation of resources into useful items, and then the distribution and the consumption and either the throwing away or the recycling of those things. Now, in nature, it's always a case of recycling because nature has a zero-waste economy. It's a closed-loop economy where the recycling is necessary to keep a finite planet evolving endlessly new species and ecosystems and things from the same materials, basically. Okay, that's one piece. I have to breathe and remember where I was going. Okay. So if we see that nature has billions of years of experience in this highly efficient and effective closed-loop economy, then we really have something to learn from that, since our economics have been linear economics, where nature has been treated not as an ecosystem in which we're included, but as an environment, an impersonal it, separate from us, that has been taken to be a pile of resources for human use. And then what we do is we take those resources, and in most cases they go through heat, beat, treat, or our high-tech agriculture that's had a lot of heat, beat, treat methods behind it. And in that kind of production method, 96% of the resources are wasted to start with. And then, of the 4% that we turn into useful things, they're usually thrown into dumps afterwards. So we have 99-plus percent waste in our economy. And that's because we've never had a science of economics. We've never tried to learn economics from nature. Another thing that's very interesting to do is, suppose you look at your body's economics. And my favorite way of telling this is to say, imagine that the northern industrial organs are above the diaphragm, and that they have the ownership of the rest of the body, so that the raw material blood cells that form in bones all over the body can be mined and shipped to these northern industrial organs. And then the heart-lung system gets into play, and the lungs clean up the blood, and oxygen is added to the blood, and then the heart distribution center announces what the body price for blood is. And you ship the blood only to those organs that can afford it. So you can see very quickly that this kind of an ownership and pricing system would not work very well in a healthy living system. In fact, some of those very bones that were mined, if you think of them as the countries in which we do a lot of mining, might not be able to afford the finished product. So there's a lot to learn from nature about economics. If you want one more piece, I'll give you a cellular piece. Okay.
What were you already did subject? My question.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Inside every one of your cells, and you have up to 100 trillion of them, the economy is about as complex as that of a large human city. Now, it's hard to really get this nano world complexity. But for example, each of your cells has about 30,000 recycling centers in it. And they are so high tech that they're equivalent of putting a dead tree into a chipper machine and getting a live tree out the other end. These recycling centers are there just to keep your proteins healthy. They pull in all the proteins that are either obsolete or damaged, and they take them apart amino acid by amino acid and put together a whole new molecule to issue from the tube that is the recycling center. Now, this is pretty amazing because Western science doesn't grant any intelligence at the cellular level. And yet, in my opinion, nature is intelligent from the get-go. And your cell knows exactly what's going on in its economy. Furthermore, each cell has about 1,000 banks. I call the mitochondria, which were once ancient free-living bacteria that came together as part of the cooperative that built our kind of cells. These mitochondrial banks are night and day issuing what Bernard Leiter would call stored value credit cards. These cards go out into the economy and are spent on every molecular transaction, every chemical process of the cell. Then when the credit line is spent, it goes back to the bank and a new credit line is put on it with no repayment demanded, much less interest charged. So night and day, your body is gifting free currency into an economy. And the role of the banks, besides issuing the currency on the credit card, is to monitor the economy for how much currency needs to flow to perfectly balance it. So the credit line will go down if there's too much currency in the cell and will go up if more is needed there. It's a system that there's no reason humans can't copy. In Western science, which has hegemony in the globe because every leading university all over the earth teaches Western science, the view of evolution comes from the Darwinian hypothesis, as everybody knows and has been taught. And in the Darwinian theory, evolution happens through an endless kind of struggle for resources, a competition over resources. Now, in the Soviet Union, all the time that the capitalist West was teaching Darwin, the communist East was teaching Pyotr Kropotkin, whose main book was Mutual Aid, and who taught the cooperative aspects of nature as the main evolution theory there. So there's been a lot of political involvement in evolution theory, if you think about it globally. And what was one of the great breakthroughs for me was recognizing that nature doesn't do either ors. It's profoundly conservative when things are going well and wildly, radically creative when things don't work and it has to do new experiments and try out new forms and things. So also, it's not going to do only competition and or only cooperation. You know, the two balance each other again. There are many opposites that are inclusive in nature and that they're used appropriately. And the appropriate way to look at the competitive side of evolution theory and the cooperative side for me was to notice that scientists talk about type 1 and type 3 ecosystems, primarily with type 2 as a mixture of the two. And in type 1 ecosystems, you have highly competitive species that are establishing themselves, that are bumping off their competition, that are being very creative and very hostile. And in type 3 ecosystems, you find that the ecology is tightly interwoven, a lot of mutual interdependency, a great deal of cooperation in them. And these are called type 3s or climax ecosystems, while the type 1s are called pioneer. Now, the way I've told it, you probably see where I'm getting. There's a maturation curve going on here. There's a youthful phase that's creative and competitive, and there's a mature phase in which the competition becomes friendly and the cooperation dominates. So once I really got that, it was just a tremendous breakthrough for me to understand why we should be looking at the most mature versions of nature, those species or those ecosystems or those bodies that have the highest degree of evolution are the ones that are cooperative. The competition comes in as the dominant feature of the juvenile phase in evolution because a species has to spread itself over territory and get enough resources to multiply. That's its drive. And so it's bumping off the others that are trying to do this insofar as it can. At some point, it seems to be the case that species bumping into each other start to negotiate and develop some cooperative schemes that turn out to be more economically efficient, cheaper in our terms, right, than killing your energy. It's cheaper to feed your enemy than to kill your enemy. So the mature form of cooperation maintains creativity by turning it into a friendly competition, like sports, like music competitions, like design competitions, where it's not about killing each other off, but about driving the best behavior or the best product. I'll tell you a little story. I was in China in 1974 at a basketball game. And when the first basket was made, the Chinese man next to me stood up and cheered and was very happy. The next basket was made by the other team. And again, he stood up and cheered and was happy. So I said, "Which is your team?" And he said, "I don't understand." I said, "Well, are you cheering for both teams?" He said, "I'm cheering for the points, the baskets." And I said, "Oh, in America we choose one team and we want that team to win, so we only cheer for it." And he said, "Oh, well, the point of having two teams play against each other is to drive excellence, and we cheer the excellence." Now notice that the basketball game was identically played to ours, but the framing was different. The first half of Earth life was devoted entirely to bacteria. They were the only cells on the planet for almost 2 billion years. And they were feisty and competitive. They even got so many technologies going, like developing motors that the nanotech technicians are trying to copy now, to invade each other, the smaller ones that were high-tech invading the larger sluggish ones, eating their resources from the inside, very much like colonialism or bacterial imperialism. And then eventually they started on this maturation cycle to develop cooperative schemes, different kinds of bacteria, which ended up as the nucleated cell, which is the only other kind of cell ever to develop on the planet. It's about 1,000 times bigger than a bacterial cell, and it's made of lots of different kinds of formerly free-living ancient bacteria working together, each having donated some of its DNA to the central library, the nucleus of the cell, and it's never had to be reinvented again. In evolution, there are only these two kinds of cells, the bacterial ones and the nucleated ones that we are made of. So then these nucleated cells had to go through a billion years of their own juvenile phase of competing with each other and multiple types of them and different ecosystems and all that. And then eventually they, in the next great leap in evolution, form the multi-celled creature. So now what I see happening in the world is globalization is our turn now to take our own species of lots of individuals and nations that have been in competition with each other and bring them together cooperatively as a global family. So we are seeing a situation now where there are more than a million NGOs, mostly grassroots, mostly trying to make life better for people at that level. We see judges talking with judges over the internet and teachers with teachers and lots of cooperative alliances developing through those great conversations. For me as a biologist, the internet is the largest living system on the planet. It's not made of computers, it's made of people using computers to connect with each other. And it's a fabulous, fabulous resource that permits the cooperation to come in, whereas most people think of globalization just as multinationals taking over the world. The real globalization that's happening is the shift from those old hostilities to the new cooperative mature mode for humanity. When you look at evolution as a process of starting out with individual competition and then finding ways to cooperate, you can see that the United States of America is a case of independent states having come together to form a union. The European Union is another one now. And during World War II, the oil companies realized that if they cooperated with each other, they were more powerful to exploit the rest of the world as a group, right? The resources and all that they could control together, where they could no longer, any one of them, get the monopoly. So these are in NATO, those alliances for security purposes or whatever, are all instances of moving into the cooperative age, but still being predominantly in the juvenile, competitive, me above everybody else kind of phase. So what we're seeing now is the multinationals have formed empires bigger than national empires, and that's just a continuation of the old empire building mode from the actual emperors to the nation states that developed their empires, and now it's the corporate empires. That's the representation of the trajectory of the youthful phase of our urbanized civilization. Many indigenous people got to the mature phase by themselves before we even developed all this urban world. Meanwhile, we see lots of instances of cooperation happening around the globe. For instance, there are more frequent world parliaments of religion and a great deal of interfaith dialogue. There are lots of exchanges among scientists and among sociologists and all kinds of people in conferences, great UN conferences on the great problems of the world. And there are also the internet that permits so much cooperative dialogue to go on. And we have an international space station now. And our communication systems went from one-to-one telephones to one-to-many broadcasts, and now the many-to-many conversations are happening all over the world. So the cooperation is kicking in, and of course those million NGOs are a big piece of it too. And the best way to understand this transition from the feisty competitive hostilities to the mature, friendly cooperation is through the metaphor of the butterfly. The caterpillar consumes hundreds of times its weight in a single day before it's finally so bloated and has cut such a swath through its ecosystem without noticing the destruction that it hangs itself up and goes to sleep, basically, and its skin forms the hardened chrysalis. Inside that chrysalis, dormant kind of undifferentiated cells, we'd call them stem cells, that have been hiding in the folds of the caterpillar's skin all along, begin to develop a whole new genome. And the little cells, as they develop, start to link up with each other. and becomes stronger, and the caterpillar's body starts to melt down into a nutritive soup for these butterfly cells to go on developing. And it is a different genome. It's as if long ago in evolution, some flippy flappy thing was eaten by some creepy crawly thing and held on to the genome. And in early evolution, there's lots of this kind of mixing and matching. Apparently, all the metamorphosing insects still carry these dual genomes that come out in sequence. So the competitive phase happened under the first genome and the cooperative phase under the second, which I love this as a metaphor because it means the future world is going to look very different. We're in huge crises and we get to reinvent everything now. We get to build that butterfly world, that living lightly on the earth instead of the heavy overconsumptive mode. We can live a lifestyle everywhere that's appropriate to this planet that will keep the ecosystems healthy as it keeps us healthy.
You can, if there's another 20 minutes of this, she's fascinating. I just loved her years ago because of the analogy, you know, if none of us would be here today if, in fact, our body wasn't working, all the systems, everything in the body wasn't working so that we imbalanced so that we could be here. And so she takes that apart and applies it to the world that we live in and how we can best then move forward in a balanced economic viable way. So you can, it's called, if you went online and you looked up her name, and she spells her name differently, it's E-L-I-S-A-B-E-T, Elizabeth, not no H. Sartoris, S-A-H-T-O-U-R-I-S. And it, I think it's called, if you go on YouTube and you put that in there, it's called Learning Economics from Nature. Learning Economics from Nature. You can listen to the second half of that. So what I'd like to do now is what we did before, just turn to the person next to you and kind of share what struck you, you know, or something new that you learned or something about what she said that has impressed you. So let's take a little bit of time with that. If anyone would like to share with the larger group some insight or comment or reflection that you have on Elizabeth's talk, you're welcome. I'll bring the microphone or you can come up. Oh, here comes Cindy. Okay. Hi.
I just wanted to share how delighted this whole morning has been. I really love the videos. I remember in the 1970s, I was a trainer for the New Games Foundation, which was from Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth Catalog. And in the 70s, we were playing, we had the big earth ball. We played it on a football field. And I traveled internationally to teach this, non-competitive games. The rules were play hard, play fair, nobody gets hurt. So we played volleyball it was the two teams against the ball. And the ball got points, and the two teams got points. So you would go under the net to help the other team get the spike that you just did, right? So in sports, it's happened. And the purity to me of the Olympic Games has been totally lost. And I think we've all known that for a long time. And we just need to bring it back. But it's certainly possible to bring all these kind of new ideas. They died, but my children were in the 80s and 90s, in public school in Los Angeles, were taught cooperative education. Some of our schools were even built in circles to create cooperative education. So there's a lot of promise in our millennials. And what they know.
Thank you, Cindy. That's fascinating.
Let me just add to that. At that time they were creating new games, but they were also adapting existing games. And the one I really loved was musical chairs. And so, you know, I thought that was the least fun thing you could possibly do. Was, you know, you ended up with one triumphant child in the middle, you know, and all these glum kids standing around looking at each other. But the variation they created was every time the moving stopped, they removed a chair, but they didn't remove a child. But they all had to pile on the remaining chairs. And so at the end, what did you have? You had this huge pile of giggling and happy children. So I just love that.
Great story. Thank you.
The idea of the butterfly and the caterpillar being two genomes I had never heard of. Now, I also believe very much in synchronicity. You know, there'd be, I mean, we could even look at that as a synchronicity. But my companion today, Teresa, in the first exercise, had commented on whether or not she had heard from her husband who died a year ago. And then she told me another story that it seems to me she had already invited to be a communication from him. So it's like we look for communications, say, from those who have passed on, sometimes in terms of the same old genome. And it might be another genome, you know, there. And especially when they occur out of a lived experience and synchronicity is there.
That's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that, and for you, Teresa. That's actually the thing that struck me is, you know, I like to think nothing's ever left behind, lost, or forgotten. And so whatever creepy crawly thing ate the flying thing, that genome from the flying thing wasn't really lost. It was just hidden in that, and eventually when the time was right, synchronicity, I thought that was totally fascinating. This is why bringing nature and, science and spirituality together is so important. The divorce between the two has really been detrimental to us understanding who we are. And so, anyhow, anybody else?
Thank you for showing those films. My brain's going bing, 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 bing. I feel like it's lighting up. And what I was touched by is how there was a continuity or a relationship between the two films, in the sense that the seed and all the potential of the seed, and also the stewardship aspect, that we are steward. I mean, that's what I also took from that, is that I also am called to a stewardship role of the seed, right? And that we are all seeds with this potentiality. It's not just in the miracle seed, it is in us. And then on the second film, I love this idea of the ecology. And again, that idea that the potentiality is all there if we cooperate. And so I was called to the idea as I'm a steward of my body too, and I don't do it that well all the time, but it's that same thing, and that my body has all this sacred potential to mature, to evolve, to grow, to deepen, to even be like the marigold seed and pop open and share the seeds. And I think we do that here with one another, with our speakers and in our individual one-on-one dialogue. So thank you. I mean, it was very inspiring and gave me a whole lot to think about. And
thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. Are we ready to wrap up? Or did you have...
I have something. Yeah, we're ready to wrap up, but...
Something that Dawn brought up about the other side of the veil and people talking to us from the other side, I wanted to give you a little anticipatory set here in education terms. I had a dream about Bob, and we were all in it. Next week I'm going to tell you the dream.
Thank you. All right, I'd like to... One more. Okay. That's okay. Oh, be careful.
I was very interested in the idea of the competition, especially with the Orientals. I have taken Ikebana for a number of years, and there are levels of learning that go on and on and on, and I never reached a very high level. And then there are the teachers. You reach a teacher level, and then there are the teachers of the teachers and the teachers of the teachers that teach the teachers, and there doesn't seem to be any end to it. They're called sensei. But they have about four times a year they have their displays. They're not competitions. We all bring in what we've done, and before it's open to the public, one of the sensei at a high level goes through and corrects each arrangement. It's an entirely different style of arranging than Western. It's based on balance and spaces in between, and it takes a different mindset. It's very hard for a Westerner like me, who loves great big arrangements where things go every which way, to really concentrate on the discipline required. And amazing to have somebody go through and just carefully move a few things you've done, and the whole picture has changed, and all of a sudden you think, wow, that's wonderful. Did I do that? No, I didn't do that. Somebody did it. But the whole room is filled like that, with every little arrangement is absolutely perfect according to the standards of Ikebana. And so then the public is admitted, and there are no prizes. Everybody is a winner. And if we could run our world that way, with just a little bit of correction here and there by those who know a little bit more about what they're doing than we do, we might have a world where everybody's a winner.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, everyone. I want to close with one of the quotes that I didn't read in the beginning, and it's from the editor of the book, Llewellyn Von Lee, in the last chapter. He says, our present ecological crisis is calling to us, and it's for each of us to respond. This crisis is not a problem to be solved, because the world is not a problem, but a living being in a state of dangerous imbalance and deep distress. This distress belongs to its body and its soul. And as the voices in this book show, there are different ways we can respond to the call. What matters is how, through our own response, we reconnect to what is sacred and return to a sense of deep belonging here in this place of wonder we call Earth. So, happy meditative reading, and thank you for today.
Thank you so much, Mary Allison. Being one of those people who always likes to voice, you know, I recognize that Alice too likes to voice, but she gave over her time to these women who have devoted years and their very life to a particular articulation. And I want to thank you for that generosity, as well as your very preparedness today for the material. Today, I should have mentioned earlier, I will do it really fast, we had an expanded audience from the north. We had Patty Grattan, and from the south, Reverend Cindy was able to get through the freeway. So it's very, very nice that we have that. Next week we have Reverend Bart Tarman. He is from, I think it's the Summerlin Presbyterian Church, and many other things. But he is going to give attention especially to his experience in nature walking the Camino del Santiago, you know, and that takes days and days of all kinds of interacting and solitude. So encourage people, if you will, to come. And I don't, I'm new with this. Anything else I forgot? No, you know that the Blue Group is going to provide the goodies. Yes, the Blue Group. All right.